So when I started writing this talk, it sounded like a great idea at first. Originally, Rusty proposed the idea to me at the symposium in Ottawa a few years ago. And I thought, yeah, that's a really, really good idea. And I started writing, pulling some of the material together. And the more I was writing, I was like, this is really, really kind of depressing. Why the hell do I do this? So an alternative title for this talk may be Why Colonel Hackers Like Beer. Because there really is sort of complete despair at certain points. On the subject of beer, I realized there's a nice sort of thing coming up soon. So last night, over some beer, I had this wonderful idea, and like I have all my best ideas over beer. So a few years ago, in fact, it was around 2001 or so, I believe, I was hacking on the OV511 driver, so webcam driver, and something kind of catastrophic happened. So this driver was kind of pretty bad at the time, wasn't working, so I made it work. And once I made it work, I kind of just left it running and thought nothing more of it. Until a few days later when my desktop locked up completely, things were crashing left and right, and I thought, what the hell just happened? It turned out that I completely ran out of disk space, and the webcam program that I was running was not only just uploading web images to a website, it was also storing a copy of the image in my home directory, and it had thousands and thousands and thousands of these wonderful JPEGs of what it had been doing for the last few days. So the results of the of this, I took all these JPEGs and concatenated them all into a movie. So this is a day in the life of a kernel hacker from about 2001. I will warn you right now, if you're offended by partial nudity, you may want to leave. Oh, this isn't happening? Fortunately, I have this enormous laptop, so I can just turn this around. People were mocking me for this. You can fix it? We have the technology. Oh, come on, do your thing. Do magic. XV?
Oh, no.
Yum. We have network. Yum install it if you need to. Yep, it's just sudo yum install. What the?
Oh, does Nplayer have it? Has it?
Yeah.
Oh, Nplayer for the Nike. Oh, not in this laptop, VOX11.
That's a lot.
Is this a talk about why Linux isn't successful on the desktop?
No, that's tomorrow.
Oh.
Just talk amongst yourselves for a minute.
Remember what the secret incantation is?
Ladies and gentlemen, Dave Ailey.
Dave.
Wow, this is extreme fail. We'll give it a few more minutes, and we might have to bypass the fantastic movie that I had set up.
I'll do VOX 11.
Yeah, VOX 11. Yeah. All these dirty secrets coming out. Seemed like a good idea at the time. Hey, we have the future of the Linux desktop. Like I said, this is the result of what happened, and a day in the life of a kernel hacker from several years ago. And there's all kinds of... This went on for days and days and just completely filled my hard disk. And we'll skip forward a little to... Oh, there we go. So this is the average day of a Linux kernel hacker just hacking away, doing his thing. Yeah, I was listening to some... I warned you. Yeah. So yeah, this went on for days and days, and so anyway. So as fascinating as this is, the life of a distro kernel maintainer isn't actually just me sat there banging away keys, hacking code and the like. And we'll actually get to some of the more interesting parts of the talk in a second. Enough of that nonsense. Anyway, where were we? So that was the amusing intro. The rest of it, it's all downhill from here. It's going to be depressing as hell. So I thought I'd spike you at the beginning and just trail off. So inside of Red Hat, we have several different teams. We're all kernel hackers, but everyone's in one of sort of three categories, as I listed there. For Fedora, there's myself, Kyle McMartin, and Chuck Abbott. And just over a year ago, it was just me. And it was pretty miserable, to be honest with you, dealing with every single Fedora bug that came in single-handedly. It was a hell of a lot of work. Even with the three of us, it's still a hell of a lot of work. We're completely swamped. And in comparison to RHEL, which, as I mentioned, is a small army of people, I'm not sure exactly how many kernel hackers we have full-time working on RHEL right now, but it's probably several dozen. The third category of people are guys who contribute to RHEL, contribute to Fedora as well, but primarily they're the upstream visible guys like Alviro, Dave M, Alan Cox, et cetera, et cetera. So the differences between the two different teams, RHEL is a boring sort of thing that makes us money at least, but it's very boring. Every 18 months we make a release and we pick one kernel version, we never ever rebase off of that. For however many years we support it, we stay on that one kernel version. And as a result of doing that, we end up having to backport all kinds of fixes that happen in the upstream kernel. And this is why we have several dozen people working on RHEL, because this is a huge mammoth undertaking. Sometimes it isn't as easy as just taking the upstream patch and just throwing it into RHEL. Sometimes it needs reworking just to apply to the older kernel. And for a complicated fix, this can take a long time. One of the worst cases that I remember was we had one patch that it was a bug in ext3 or the journal block layer, I forget which. And the upstream patch took maybe 2 days to hash out, okay, in, done, no problems. It took Stephen Tweedy about 2 weeks to do the RHEL version because we had all these complicated things. We do all sorts of other silliness in RHEL as well, like we try to maintain a kernel ABI for external modules. It has its plus point for users in that they can take a module and just compile it and the interface hasn't changed, so everything is all wonderful. For kernel developers, it's a complete pain in the ass. So that's the horrible side of this job. Fedora, conversely, is released a lot more often. Every 6 months, we push out another release. We slip a little now and again, but we try to get on a six-month schedule. Frequent updates in that as soon as Linus makes a new point release, we'll push out an updated kernel for Fedora, rebasing to that release. This has its pluses and minuses as well. It's great in that we get all the shiny new features that are happening upstream. It's also great, well, not so great, that we also get all the shiny new bugs that have been implemented upstream. So sometimes it's a case of trading off one set of bugs that we used to have for a different set of bugs, but keeps people busy at least. We also have, for the released distros, like for example right now Fedora 7 and 8, we always have the latest stable release, so it'd be 2.6, well, 24 right now, but until recently it was 2.6.23.12, I believe, or something, whatever it was. As soon as they come out, we push out an update for those. The development version, i.e. Fedora, what's going to be Fedora 9 right now, that's always, or nearly always, the Linus's kernel of the day, the latest dash git snapshot. At Fedora, we typically have three releases in flight at once. So when F9 comes out, we'll retire F7, and we'll also have a new development for what will be F10. So then we'll have F8, 9, and what will be 10. So how do we go about all this? How does this happen? So we usually just pick the latest kernel that's out at the time. We try to figure out how far ahead, how many times can we actually rebase in this release? This is just about the Fedora side of things for now. I'm not really going to talk about the RHEL thing just yet. I'll touch on it a little more later. But Fedora, with us having a six-month cycle and upstream releasing a new kernel every 2 to 3 months, if we're lucky, we can pull off two rebases every single release and have the absolute latest kernel that Linus has dropped in the release. And we usually end up with sort of 2 or 3 weeks at the end of our release schedule to hammer down any last-minute nasties that crop up. The as well as picking the kernel, every time Linux makes a new kernel and we rebase to a new release, one of the first things that we have to do is take a look at all the new configuration options that have been added and decide whether or not we want to enable these. And sometimes it's fairly obvious if it's just like a new driver. Typically, why would we not want to enable a driver for a user? So there are actually cases where we don't want to enable certain new drivers. For example, some drivers are so experimental and half-baked that if we give it to a user and eats his file system, he's not going to be too happy. So sometimes we have to make a judgment call and decide whether or not to enable something. But for the most part, we enable all the shiny new stuff that comes down. We also have a problem. We have this problem where if upstream deprecates something and adds a configuration option to turn on these old deprecated functions, sometimes we have to leave all that stuff enabled if our user space isn't up to date enough. And how we usually find this out is while it's in the devel releases, we'll try turning off all the backwards compatibility stuff and see what breaks. If nothing breaks, great, we'll leave all the legacy junk turned off. Sometimes this takes a while. We'll turn the stuff off and think, oh, great, nothing broke. We'll leave it off. And then 2 or 3 months later, someone says, hey, this doesn't work. And you have to do some head scratching, and eventually you find out, you backtrack and find out that it was because you turned off the things it's relying on. So once we have the kernel, we've got the options all lined up. Sometimes we have to add some patches. It's pretty much an inevitability. I don't think we've ever shipped any kernel release in as far back as I can remember without any patches. I did some research on the least amount of patches that we ever shipped was, I think it was Red Hat Linux 4.something, and it was less than 10 patches. I think it was like 7 patches or something. These days things are a little different, but I'll go on to talk about that in a second. And then we just kick off the build and shiny RPMs fall out the other side and end up in the distro. So going back to patches, these are the historical patches, number of patches that we've carried in various releases. So the Red Hat Linux days, I mean, we got the very first one was still a 2.2 kernel, which goes way back. And we had 70 patches there. And all the 7x, 8x, and 9x, which was when I started working at Red Hat, I inherited these as the very first thing. It was great. At the time, I was working for SUSE, and I was told about this Fedora thing. It's going, it's going to be great. We're going to have this really close to upstream thing. You're just the guy to come work on this. It'll be great. So I bought into all this. I thought, yeah, sounds great. I'm going to jump ship and go work for Red Hat. So I arrive at Red Hat and they say, yeah, about that Fedora thing, that's not happening just yet. So use Red Hat 7, 8, and 9. Go. So the first 6 months of working at Red Hat were great fun maintaining these kernels. And
were
by
they really all 2.4.20 based?
They were. Yes, they were all based on 2.4.20, and the only differences between them, we actually had to do separate builds for all of them. They weren't the same RPMs because there were compiler differences, and some of them had different patches. The spec files for these RPMs are completely horror show, and I actually looked back at them for some reason last week, and to look at it now, and looking back, thinking, how the hell did we ever cope with this? Because it's just complete despair. We had conditional patches that were applied on certain architectures and all sorts of horrors, and it was really ugly. So to give you an example, Red Hat 9 had backports of all the threading stuff that we had added in the 2.5 kernel. So all of Uli Draper's work and Ingo's work, all the MPTL stuff, that was all in there. But it was not in the earlier releases, so that's why we had to do different builds. And it's also why the Red Hat 9 patch count is slightly higher than some of the others, because there were so many 2.5 backports in there. That leads on to the, it doesn't. So in comparison, Fedora. So the very first Fedora release, it was, from the kernel point of view as well, it was pretty much Red Hat Linux 10. We took what was the CVS repository for Red Hat 9 and just rebased it to 22. And it was a lot of work at the time because, blimey. I was pretty green. I just started at Red Hat and I was still getting up to speed. And it was a good sort of learning process to get used to all the various, how things work in Red Hat and how all the things managed with CVS and the build system and all that kind of thing. So there wasn't a lot of sort of development or anything fun going on there. It was mostly a me getting up to speed thing. Piss off. Gah. This doesn't want to go. Anyway, so Fedora Core 2, the dream finally came true. It was like, we're finally on the what's new upstream, and we're fairly close to upstream, but we still had 78 patches in the... We have it down as a 2.6.10 kernel. That's actually the updates. That was the final update that we pushed out for 2.6.10. The initial Fedora Core 2 kernel, I believe, was 2.6.5. So we did rebases fairly frequently back then, and we got quite a few updates pushed out. But the initial patch count when we made the first release was in the same ballpark. What do we have? So one of the reasons that it also has quite a high patch count there was Fedora Core 1 never rebased. We released at 2.4.22 and we never moved to 23 or 24. And the reason for that was partly because it was carrying all those damn backports from 2.5. It had all the MPTL, it had the 4, no, it actually had all sorts of other nasty things as well, like Ingo's 4 gig patch and all these real horror show stuff. So rebasing to a new point release back then with all this junk in the kernel was a real nightmare. So we chose not to do it. And as a consequence of that, it meant for 2.4.23 came out, we cherry-picked all the bits that when users reported bugs, we thought, okay, we'll have this patch and this patch, and we'll fix these problems. So yeah, that was pretty horrific. Moving on to Fedora Core 2, like I said, every time Linus made an update, we followed suit and we pushed them out very quickly. And this has been true ever since. We've done this all the way through for every Fedora release since. FC 5 and 6 are kind of an exception there. If you notice, the numbers here are kind of, they kind of stand out here. That's where the peak is. And the reason for that is when we released Fedora 7, 2.6.21 was a bit of a lemon. So we decided not to do a 21 update for 5 and 6, which we were still supporting at the time. So we were doing lots of the backporting thing like we did in the earlier days because 21 was pretty horrific from our point of view with the number of bugs we were coming in. When 23 came out, we actually did do an update for Fedora 6. We did do an update, no, for Fedora 7. We did do an update to bring that to 23. We skipped 22 completely. So we still have quite a few, given that Fedora 9 is, the develop tree is still, that's pretty recent. I mean, 24 was only released last week and we had 91 patches in there then. This is going to go down significantly over the next week or so now that the 2.6.25 merge window has opened up. So I expect a third to a half of these to go away. I'll go into the reasons why some of them won't go away in a minute. As a comparison, RHEL is completely horror show. Wow. So as you can see there, because we don't ever rebase the RHEL releases, patches tend to accumulate lots. Not rebasing means you get all these ridiculous numbers of patches that go into the tree, stay there, never go away. And another interesting point here is RHEL 4, just over 1,000 patches. That was that's over a 3-year period. RHEL 5, 1,600 patches. RHEL 5 was released last March. We exceeded 3 years worth of patches from RHEL 4 in less than a year. And there's a number of reasons for this. One of them is that upstream is moving a lot faster, and we're pulling a lot more fixes in indirectly from that. We're cherry-picking a hell of a lot more because a lot more stuff is getting found and getting found faster. We also have a lot more people working on it now. I haven't got numbers of how many people in the RHEL team, but since the RHEL 4 days, I think we probably either a third to twice as many as what we had in the earlier days. So that's still pretty shocking, though. I mean, that's a lot of patches. Well, it's RHEL 6 is pretty much equal to Fedora right now because it's the same tree. We haven't forked off from it. So, I mean, I have no idea when we're going to do so because, blah, 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 forward-looking statements. But. Yeah. If you're a RHEL 5 sysadmin, how long should you be pulling patches? Well, we have for RHEL, we have a number of different strategies. We have two separate streams. We have what we call the Z stream, which is it doesn't, you know, you do a U1, U2, U3 release every however many months. In between those, we have these little forks off of the previous U release, and they don't get as much sort of, they just get the security fixes and absolutely critical stuff. So you, as soon, if you wanted to follow that path, you could just pick those patches, you know, as soon as they come out. The larger U releases, we have a number, some of our customers have various different strategies. Some of them, they want the absolute latest shiny bits all the time because they have new hardware and they need these updates to make that hardware go. We also have customers that hang back and stay on an older release because it works great for them and they're afraid of regressing. So I don't really have a good answer for you. It's just whatever works for you. But we've, like I said, we've given you the two options there. So take your pick. Okay. So a different kind of metric is the actual size of all these patches. So Red Hat Linux 9, we had 216,000 lines of code change in all the patches. This is the patches we added to our release that weren't upstream. In comparison, RHEL 5, 1.8 million lines of code have changed. Fedora Devel, 261,000. That's still a hell of a delta. But a lot of that delta is actually, it's kind of in-flight stuff. Like we have various Git trees in Fedora, like the latest wireless bits, for example. That takes up a huge chunk of that 261,000 lines. So whilst it looks like we're even worse than we were in the Red Hat Linux days, we're just pulling stuff that's pending for the next upstream release anyway, so I don't feel quite so bad carrying those things. Also, another reason that it's larger is we have twice as much code to patch now as we did in the Red Hat Linux days. The source tree has doubled in size over the years. So with a lot more drivers and file systems and so on, there's a lot more stuff that could go wrong that needs patching. So types of patches that we actually end up carrying. I also already mentioned that we always rebase to the latest stable release, or very nearly always. I'll mention some of the exceptions in a minute. We carry a whole bunch of little bits and pieces that just haven't found their way upstream. Some of them may one day, some of them probably won't. I mean, things like the exec shield, for example. This was before CPUs had NX bits to stop buffer overflows when by marking the stack as non-executable. Ingo Molnar came up with this really ugly, nasty hack that abuses x86 segment limits to approximate this feature. It's brilliant. I mean, it works, no problem at all. Unfortunately, Linus took extreme offense to it and said, "Ugh, I can't believe you did that. It's really cool, but please, not for my kernel." There was various other bits of exec shield a while ago as well. Like we had all the address space randomization in there. We had a bunch of other little security tweaks. And over time, these have slowly started making them their way upstream. And as of 2.6.25, the only bit of it left is going to be the NX approximation or emulation or whatever you want to call it. So we'll always end up carrying that unless Linus has a change of heart. U-trace is, that's an awkward one. So Roland re-implemented the p-tracing with this thing called U-trace. He then went on to injure himself and break his arm, so he just kind of sat in the tree without being worked on for ages, and it's had all these other problems along the way that's stopped it getting upstream. For example, the way he initially did it, every architecture was forced to implement it. This, it turns out, was a bit of a problem for some architectures which couldn't actually do some of the things that U-trace demanded of it. So apparently he's rewriting that, or he's rewritten it to make it opt-in per arch. So that has a chance of getting upstream at some point, but until it does, well, we end up carrying it. We restricted the dev mem interface as another security improvement a while back. And the reason for this is, for the most part, nothing should ever be poking around in DevMem. The most common thing that was reported that by restricting it, the reason we did it is a lot of rootkits would actually use this to patch various internals in the kernel, like the system call table, for example. So by taking this attack vector away, no problem anymore. All these rootkits don't work. The only other thing that really uses it, well, there's a few things that used to use it. There was things like DMI decode used to use it. The X server used to use it for, I think it still does use it actually, for a certain range of memory. So we don't ban it completely, ban usage of it completely. We just restrict the old window to the bits that need to be looked at. Oh, and the other thing it's useful for is kernel debugging. So sometimes it does have its usage, but you can turn that on and off. And that actually might end up going upstream for 2.6.25. So we'll see how that goes. Other stuff we add, sometimes we need little compile fixes. We'll find things that slipped in upstream that just broke the compile for us, especially on the sort of more niche architectures. x86 stuff usually gets noticed very quickly when that doesn't compile. Everything else is, sometimes it drags its heels, especially the really weirdo architectures like S390 and all those sorts of things. Sometimes they'll upstream will be broken for maybe a week or two until the architecture maintainer does another sync with Linus and fixes everything up all in one go. Sometimes we want to change something in the kernel we're shipping, and it doesn't have a config option. An example of this would be for the longest time, the Linux VFS actually supported up to 8 levels of symlinks to symlinks to symlinks to symlinks, but upstream had it set to 5. And we had customers who were saying, hey, I want more than 5 layers of symlinks for whatever reason they were doing. So we change little things like that every so often. We make little tweaks if it's if it makes sense to do so. Over time, these things do tend to become configurable or the new default actually gets upstream. So this is kind of these are usually come and go patches. Sometimes we have users who really, really freak out when they see things on their console. Really pointless messages that they can't do anything about. A classic one is this from the input layer saying, spurious ACK, some program may be trying to access hardware directly. What's the user supposed to do with that? So the answer seems to be tell Red Hat. So they file bugs in Bugzilla, and we think, oh, great, it's nothing to worry about, don't worry about it. And time and time again, they come back with more. Different users report it. And it gets to a critical point where you think, enough, and you just get rid of the print K. Sometimes it's just a case of we don't get rid of the print K, we'll lower the log level. Another one was the network layer, which I have these patches that you meant to send to Dave, but I haven't got around to it. On receiving certain packets, lots and lots of messages get spewed. So we lower the level of those. They just go into the demessage buffer rather than spewing it all over your console. So I already mentioned we carry some Git trees. In fact, we carry quite a few of the Git trees. This is all the stuff that's in flight, usually for the next development release. So we have all the latest wireless drivers, the AGP bits, you have your 3D going on, and we carry Nouveau, the NVIDIA reverse engineering doodads. That's going to be fantastic. New sound drivers. The sound drivers, that's a great example, because what we found with ALSA is if we ship the version that's in Linus's kernel, and a user reports a bug, if we then tell the ALSA guys, the first thing they would say is, does it happen with the latest version of the driver, which is usually true to the next release. So shipping all these sort of in-flight bits is the only way we can actually get the developers to give a damn about bugs we're reporting. So FireWire bits, EXT4 stuff, and we carry some PowerPC bits that are still pending merging. So at the kernel summit this year, one of the topics that came up was that various distros carry various drivers that aren't upstream. And the analogy that came up was a crap driver is better than no driver. A user wants their hardware to work, and with no driver in the tree, they're holding a brick. They've got no way of using that driver. And some of the drivers they're out of tree for a reason, because the code quality is appalling. I'm not specifically picking on these two some of the code that we've recently picked up has been the infrared drivers that have been lingering out of tree for God knows how long that just never seem to make it upstream. They do now, because what actually happened is they wanted help, basically. They wanted someone to say, help us get this upstream. We haven't got time to do it ourselves. We want to hack drivers. Help us clean it up. Help us get it mergeable, and all will be, love all around.
If they've said that, that helps.
Yeah. So we're trying to go out of our way to help some of these people now to do this thing. And another project that we've recently, well, actually in the last week or so we've picked up is we're trying to beat some of the webcam drivers into shape, because as it turns out, webcam support in the kernel is pretty dire right now. Most of the drivers in Tree, you can't buy the hardware for them anymore. That's how bad things are. There's all the little special case. We had drivers for things like the camera in the OLPC or the camera in the MacBook or all the shiny new things. Sometimes that gets a driver. But commodity stuff, you can just go to a computer store and buy, take home, plug in your USB gizmo. The chances are most of the drivers in the Tree are too old or just does not exist in Tree. And a lot of these exist out of Tree, but it's just a complete pain in the ass to have users having to build these by hand and so on. So that's something we're working on now, trying to beat some of those into shape to get those ready for upstream submission. And again, that's another case of the guys working on them, they want to hack code, they want to like just work on drivers, they haven't got time to actually do all the cleaning things up and conforming to coding style and all that kind of nonsense. So it's mostly sort of, it's low-hanging fruit, it's not a massive undertaking, but it just needs work done. I mean, there's a lot of work to do, but it's happening. You had a question?
Just comment. I mean, Greg Ferrari claimed he had several hundred device driver developers.
Yeah.
Help with device
drivers. Yeah. Greg's project is, he's got a bunch of hardware vendors who've got all these sort of things like industrial control devices and all sorts of things like this, and they've got people signing up the right drivers for this, which is great. A lot of the existing drivers at a Tree, it's a great project for people to get involved in, you know, to actually do this cleanup work. I think some of the people in that signed up for Greg's project are actually looking at this, but I haven't seen any sort of fruits of this yet. I haven't seen anything come out of it. So I'm optimistic maybe one day we'll see the same kind of thing coming out of that, and it'll be great. So, security fixes. So you might think that, okay, the previous page said you always update to the latest stable. Surely that has the security fixes. Sometimes it takes a day or so, and if it takes 2 days for the stable release and the patch is already public, there's no point hanging around waiting for that to for the upstream stable release to happen. When a patch exists, we can just push out an update carrying that security fix. These tend to live very, very short time. These go away the next time we rebase to a stable release. We get a lot of users filing bugs, oddly enough, and sometimes we haven't got a damn clue what the hell is going on, and we need more information. And the only way we can tend to do this sometimes is by adding patches to the kernel. Things like systemtap and kprobes and all these sort of things, they're great, but sometimes it's really, really difficult. For certain types of problems, it's just not really feasible. And the only way you can do it is by adding instrumentation to the kernel. So you add maybe a boot parameter. So the user seeing this problem boots with this parameter and he gets extra spew in his D message and he forwards that back to us. So sometimes we throw little passages like that in to try to figure out what the hell is going on. We have a bunch of patches in the kernel that, the Fedora releases and the RHEL releases, while they're booting up, you don't get any text on the screen at all. You get the little splash screen with the progress bar and so on, and the desktop guys think this is awesome and great and lovely. From a kernel debugger point of view, it's a real pain in the ass. When users say, I'm trying to boot the latest update and my machine just locks up before it even gets to X, what do I do? The first thing we have to tell them to do is go into the grub menu and delete the word quiet off the end of the command line and boot again. Then they can tell us what the last line of text on the screen was. For the development tree, we go a little further. We disable the ability for quiet to actually work. So you always get text on the rawhide kernels. So that's a little patch we add for that. There's lots of other little debugging tweaks like that we do. This is a sliding window patch set where patches come in, and every time we drop one, we always seem to add another one. So we've always got a handful of debugging things going on in there. Sometimes the debugging things are kind of generically useful enough that they actually do go upstream. An example of this was we added some patches to debug the linked list walking routines. So when you delete a node, we made sure all the pointers actually were sane, that kind of thing. And this picked up a whole bunch of little bugs. And this was useful enough and generic enough that this could go upstream. Other things like that were when we printed, when we had, say, slab corruption or various other kinds of kernel, oh my God, something really bad just happened. When we printed that text, we added an extra printk to print the status of the tainted flag, so we could see if the user had some binary-only module or whatever loaded. And this was really handy for sort of just looking for patterns. Every time you saw this, every time this corruption pattern appeared, oddly enough, they had this driver loaded. It's probably that driver. Sorry? Okay, I'll try to speed up a little. Sometimes we have stuff that gets vetoed upstream, and it's kind of stuff we can't not ship. We have to do it. A case in point, the Intel E1000 driver, sometimes it just loses its marbles completely, and it just can't talk to its EEPROM, and it thinks, ah, the MAC address is 00000. There's a way to actually correct the EEPROM. You run ETHtool on it, and then it rewrites the EEPROM, and everything's wonderful again. The only problem is you need an ETH interface to actually for ETHtool to talk to. You can't actually get an ETH interface if the EEPROM isn't there or is corrupt. So we added a boot parameter to say ignore the EEPROM checksum and bring up the interface no matter what, so you can actually run ETHtool against it and fix your EEPROM. The upstream maintainers of this Intel, the answer was, this should never happen. Well, that's great and all, but I've personally had two boxes that have suffered from this. It does happen. And we had users that have had it, so we have to ship things like this.
Dave, I won the war with the E100 driver, so you should say.
Oh, my hero.
And you'll win the one with the E1000, no worries.
So another example is someone sent a patch, actually attached a patch to Fedora Bugzilla, which is completely unheard of. To add support for the serial layer for 460800 board. The upstream serial maintainer said, well, I don't want to merge this because it might regress some of the other things and I want testing to happen and blah, 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 blah. And we've been fighting about this for about 2 years now, and in the meantime, upstream kernels don't support this board rate on all these UARTs, whereas the Fedora kernel does. Must-haves, the installer team, Cramfest, just didn't compress enough, so we had to ship SquashFS. Pretty much every distro is doing this now, and it's only inevitable that at some point SquashFS will end up going upstream. Carrying the Nouveau tree triggered a compile error, or actually triggered a GCC4.1 bug. We shipped GCC4.1 in that distro where it's triggered, on PowerPC32. So we had to add a compile fix just for that. So little things like that can tend to add. Sometimes upstream takes a while to get a fix in order, and we have to work around it in another way. An example, IDE CDDMA was busted on a whole bunch of IDE chipsets for a while, and while that was being worked out, the only way we'd actually get to install in those boxes was by disabling DMA altogether. It's a pretty nasty workaround, but it gets people able to install. So building Fedora kernels. So we take a tarball, we have patches in CVS, and some makefile magic happens, and an SRPM pops out. The SRPM, after the other side of the, after it gets thrown into the build system, outputs 27 binary RPMs. The build system takes 3 or 4 hours to output all those, and the Fedora release engineering team love us because each build that we do takes up 0.5 gig of disk space. Every time they buy a new file storage unit, we tend to use up a hell of a lot of it real fast. And the reason is we have all these different kernel RPMs. x86 has 4 different flavors. PPC has 4 different flavors. We have all the debugging symbols from all of the above. These things are absolutely enormous. I'm trying to speed up so I get all this stuff in. It goes on and on. We have the source RPM. We have documentation RPM. We have all the kernel headers for user space. We have the deval packages for people to build modules against all those kernels. So there's a lot of RPMs that get thrown up. Just before we do a release, we tend to disable all things like checking of the slab object and spin lock debugging so that people get their performance in their shiny new kernel. At the same time, we also start building debug kernels, which have all the extra things turned on. So the 27 kernels is now 30-something. And that has all the extra checking. Right before we do a release, we stop rebasing. Even if upstream releases a new stable release, we will not move to that release. If we've got a few days before we actually start shipping the ISOs to the mirrors, we will not rebase. And the reason we do this was we got bitten really, really hard for Fedora 7 when we did a rebase, to the extent where Dell laptops would not boot unless you booted with max CPUs equal 1. Somehow this rogue patch ended up in the stable releases. So sometimes stable, not so much. So things that we do throw in with the last few days of release, really, really critical stuff only. Fixes, my machine doesn't boot sort of bugs, or my Ethernet doesn't work, so users are able to download updates. Has to fix a data corruption bug where a corrupt file system equals fail, so we have to patch that. Critical security bug. By critical here, this usually means deferring to the Red Hat security team, and they have an assessment for every security bug that we get. And if they decide this isn't remotely exploitable or this is a real corner case, don't worry about it, fix it in the update on day one of release. Sometimes we tend to not do that. We'll just actually ship with the whole. Because like I said, we tend to always have an update on day one. So post-release, usually the first day of a release, we've got an update ready, which updates to the latest 2.6.xy, fixes all those last minute bugs, all the little security bugs and what have you. And for the most commonly reported bugs, we try to get fixes in for as many of those as possible. Afterwards, we'll keep moving towards the latest 2.6.xy. If Linus drops a new 2.6n+1, we'll eventually move to that as well. Well, by eventually, I mean pretty quickly. So updates, we have the latest 2.6.xy. We have bug fixes that we backport from Linus's developer. The debug patches I mentioned earlier, we throw those into the updates. Ongoing work. So as well as doing all this throwing patches into the tree and building and pushing out, there's the other side of the problem where Bugzilla is a complete disaster. I mean, we just get swamped, absolutely inundated with bugs. The numbers you see by the size of the releases here, that's the current, how many open kernel bugs we have. So we have 153 Fedora 7 kernel bugs, 287 F8. The developer, which is Linus's kernel today, has 313 open bugs. A lot of these kernels are so close together as well with regards to which release they're based upon, that these bugs are pretty much applicable across all three releases. The kernel log Bugzilla right now has 1,200 open bugs. There's a lot of cruft in there. It really needs a lot of love to throw out some of the real nasty churn. So we continue pushing out regular updates. And the other side of this is there's a lot of interaction with upstream maintainers. I mean, we get so many bugs that we don't have the time between the three of us to give every bug our full attention. And the only way we can actually stay on top of some of this is by bringing in the upstream people and saying, hey, don't have a damn clue what's going on here. We've done the initial triage of this. Take a look. And sometimes working with the upstream maintainers works really, really well. Some of them will fall over themselves to help us. Some of them will tell us to piss off and come back when you're running a kernel log kernel. It's a bit of a mix, really, the kind of response we get from upstream maintainers. I'm not sure why I wrote no-brainers in response to upstream maintainers. some of them do have brains. Sometimes that there's a problem. We'll have something's been fixed in a different way. We'll end up with a fix in the Fedora tree, and the upstream maintainer will end up, I want to fix this in a different way. And there's a lot of back and forth there. So there's a lot of communication going on between the upstream maintainers and us. How am I doing for time? Am I really close to the end?
5 minutes.
I think we'll go straight to questions. I think that's actually my last slide anyway. Not close. And then there's the working with the various teams inside Red Hat. I mean, things like the desktop team, for example, always want to know the status of various things relevant to the desktop. And sometimes this requires not just from the desktop point of view, but just this point in total. It requires you paying attention and caring about stuff that you may not give a damn about. I'm well known for my love of virtualization. I've had it with virtualization. I mean, I think it's just, I can't believe just how much mileage this buzzword has gained over the few years, and it still seems to be gaining traction in certain crowds. But as much as I'd love to, I have to keep on top of what's happening with things like KVM and sadly Xen and a whole bunch of other little bits and pieces. So just staying on top of upstream development and some of the out-of-tree development, it's a mammoth undertaking. There's so much to keep on top of that you never really get the time to focus on one thing in depth and learn everything about that. You tend to just skim the surface and just kind of, you know, you have a kind of a 20,000 mile high view of a problem or the latest state of something. And this, the same is true of code. Because there's just the three of us and we're inundated with bugs, what tends to happen is we'll have a cutoff where if a certain bug is taking past a certain length of time, we'll try to punt that off to someone else because you could just spend forever just root causing one bug, and in that time, all the other bugs are being completely neglected. And some of those bugs may be little 5-minute things that that more users are actually seeing than the bug that you just spent 2 days trying to diagnose. That is all I've got, so I'm going to go straight to questions, I think. So pretty much anything, I'd rather keep questions related to Fedora if you can, because I'm kind of out of touch with RHEL development myself, but I'll attempt to answer RHEL questions if you have those too. Any questions? Go. How many people are using Fedora? As of Fedora 7, I believe, we started installing a system service called Smolt. And what this does is it's an opt-in service that periodically checks in with a server in the Fedora project or old domain. And it does all sorts of things, like it tells us the user's hardware, it tells us what packages they have installed and that kind of thing. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but if you go to smolt.fedoraproject.org, it's all on there. You can see how many machines have checked in. It's not a perfect representation because, like I said, it's opt-in and not everyone does. There's a whole bunch of other sort of, it's the usual problem with statistics. It's very easy to make them appear one thing when it's something else. You can massage the numbers to your own satisfaction. I don't think there's a real perfect way of doing user counting, and it seems every distro seems to go about it differently, so it's hard to gauge how we compare to other distributions in that sense. I believe so. From memory, I believe it is actually, it's either sort of maintaining or it hasn't decreased significantly, I don't think, anyway. Anything else? Yep, go.
Yeah, is Fedora and Andy the subset of the architectures in the kernel world? And also, do you have like Fedora running and then offline?
Okay, I'm going to reword your question a little as to what architectures do we support in Fedora? Yeah. Is that a simpler version of your question? Okay, so primarily it's x86, x86-64, PowerPC, PowerPC-64. I think i64 is a primary arch. Then we have what we call secondary arches. This is still something we're trying to hash out, and Fedora 9 is actually going to be the first one where we ship actual secondary arches. We haven't done this before, but we're going to be shipping, I believe, a Spark 64 release. Someone is working on an ARM release. Whether that lands in time for the regular F9 release or it'll release afterwards, asynchronously, I don't know, but they are being worked on. There's all sorts of people hand-wave and do silly ideas every so often, like, hey, I'm going to do a PA RISC Fedora and all this kind of thing, but until that was cut. Yeah, that was Kyle, yeah. But until these things appear, then, it's just pie in the sky. This is what we're currently still hashing out. One of the proposals is, say we're doing a kernel build, right? As I mentioned, these take 2 or 3 hours. The less loved architectures upstream tend to break quite often with regards to compile. And because some of these architectures are kind of slow, they take a while to actually get to the compile error. The way the Fedora build system works right now, if we spend 2 hours building all these x86 kernels and then the PowerPC32 kernel fails the compile, we throw away everything. One of the notions that's been proposed for secondary arches is if a secondary arch fails, the primary arches still go on to completion. So it'll raise a flag saying, this is busted, someone needs to fix this. But in the meantime, it's not going to slow down the primary arches. That just carries on as if nothing happened. Okay? There's a bunch of other little changes as well, but that's one of the things that's been proposed.
We've got time for one last question.
Make it a good one.
No, okay.
No one has one?
Please join me in thanking Dave for a wonderful presentation.